Humanity is growing and connecting. Tomorrow's world needs more energy from more places.
But to find our net zero future, we must overcome the natural constraints of many new energy sources.
This is the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast, where we look at the energy challenges of modern life and the innovators finding solutions. Join us for a low-carbon, high-energy conversation with your host, Joe Battier.
This views of the host are his own and should not be viewed as those of any business, corporation, or government entity.
All right, we are recording. This is the recording for the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast with Emily Easley. Emily, before we get started, can I have your verbal permission to use the audio and visual recordings for publication purposes?
Yes.
All right. Okay, so now we will get started. Hello, and welcome to the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Battier. This is the show where we bring you low-carbon, high-energy stories from the people solving the energy challenges of modern life. I am here today with Emily Easley, CEO of Novus Energy Advisors. As the name implies, Novus provides advisement on the energy landscape, both in oil and gas, renewables, and the changing landscape with the evolving energy mix. So today, we are going to talk big picture about the state of energy right now as we are rounding out the first quarter of 2024 and looking forward into what's happening. So, Emily, thank you for joining me on the show today. If you would please share with me and the audience your background and a quick introduction to Novus Energy Advisors.
Sure, Joe. Thank you for having me. And it's always good to talk about, entering a new season. Spring is ahead and there's just been so much going on already in this year. Our background is, we're a boutique advisory firm. I've been in the energy business my entire career. I was born and raised in Texas, and I know that I'm jealous that you're there right now. Moved to the DC area in 2003 and entered the solar business really out of just a need for an entry-level job, and had just studied the Enron collapse at Vanderbilt, and was really intrigued to see, what was happening in the DC area as far as energy, but had a deep background in oil and gas, just being born and raised and then multiple generation Texan. So a great appreciation for the history. And we advise our clients from large public companies to small PE, starter companies, PE-backed starter companies, and really as far as supporting them and just this landscape that is constantly evolving and changing from regulatory policy information, technology questions, and then also just market-driven business models where the opportunities and risk are.
That is, it sounds like a lot to handle and a lot to take in and also be responsible for guiding your clients. So I'm glad that we have you on the show to be talking about this large landscape since you've been doing this and looking at it. So I'd like to start with one idea of renewable power installation. How is the renewable power installation at this time? Because I feel like I hear mixed reports.
Well, you and I had spoken about this, offline, and I think it's important to say, the total capacity and penetration on an annual basis is broken into different market segments. And so, solar means different things as far as numbers per customer type. So, as far as utility scale, the huge, huge, big solar and wind projects that take up, big acreage, those have exploded largely due to the IRA. But, over the last decade, really, the technology cost has come down. The production and efficiency of the panels have increased. And so, on a year-over-year basis, you've seen this exponential growth. And so there's only, so much space and interconnection opportunities in the wholesale grid. It's a complicated regulatory market that I think is often overlooked as far as power policy and just regional markets, and then how all of that kind of flows up into FERC, the DC-based regulatory commission. And so, you know, that has its own kind of interesting dynamics that are changing. Then you have the commercial market, and then you have the residential. We don't tap too much into residential. Residential, I'll just speak to it for just a Texas perspective. What's interesting is, you know, ever since the hurricane, the ice storm Uri, you know, ERCOT itself is what regulates the state power market in Texas. And so there have been some really interesting business models that have been driven by residential customer options as it relates to storage. And then you're seeing solar kind of behind that. But as it relates to the commercial side of the business, that's been an untapped market that's been really hard to unlock just in the last 20 years. There was a kind of business model that broke through in 2004 and 2005, right when the tax credits ended up passing, to allow for nonprofits to procure the cleaner power, but had a tax equity partner come in to the business structure. So through the power purchase agreements, but you know, the scale and speed that really is needed as far as commercial customers and then dealing with rooftops has been challenged. It took off due to, you know, some of the for-profit companies, but the changes in the tax credit policy as it relates to the IRA and direct pay, now you're seeing that market move in a way that it was really bottlenecked before. And then utility scale, you know, has curtailed a bit. I mean, these were land position plays with the right interconnection spots that a lot of the developers who became very sophisticated in their development process took positions that now are, a lot of them are bottlenecked into the interconnection queue. So getting permitting and approval to interconnect the size of the project, and then ensuring that aligns with your access to the right equipment at the exact time that you need for it all to move forward and start to build. All of those complications are kind of amplifying what was already a flood of papers that, you know, had developers kind of waiting in line to get approval to move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you just mentioned the idea of this curtailing. There was a big explosion, and now maybe we're still growing, but not growing as fast as we were. And you mentioned, go ahead.
Well, I think the total capacity in the U.S. is still growing. I mean, with renewables and solar in general, I mean, there's the resources are, largely just more vast than some of the underground geological formations that we pull out. So I think you're going to continue to see the ramp up of innovative business models and some really interesting technologies coming down the pack. But I do think that, you know, we saw a huge flood after the IRA. I think you're starting to continue to see smaller utility scale projects that can get into the mix in a portfolio type structure. That is an interesting opportunity for developers, but the utility scale, huge projects that are kind of stuck in the permitting process and interconnection queues continues to be a challenge.
So you've mentioned the IRA a few times, and I think I don't follow policy as much, but I think we're almost a year since the IRA was put in place. Maybe something along that line. So a decent amount of time, and by now we should be seeing a lot of movement. What you're saying, there is a lot more projects going online because of these IRA incentives. Now, from the geothermal side, I've looked at it and tried to understand where and how these incentives go into practice. And there's, for anybody who doesn't know, there's something like five different ways to add up to the largest incentive possible. So with the complexity of the IRA, where have you seen the biggest impact, or how has the IRA really impacted the U.S. energy market?
I mean, it's such a big question, right? I mean, this was the largest tax policy package that was historic to get passed. And what was included in 700 plus pages were policies that had been in the works for a decade, right? I mean, so each technology or tax structure or different location and the value add to the local economy. It's complex, and the various groups that it ultimately is designed to support, right? So when you look at how the tax credits are stacked and then what has been rolling out from Treasury as far as further definition that is necessary. For example, the hydrogen tax credit just had another ruling as far as the clarity as to what qualifies. You know, there's policy that gets passed, and as it was before, if it was extended, then that's pretty clear. Adding these additional location benefits, whether it be an environmental justice communities, the requirements that if you procure American-made product and equipment using American labor with apprenticeship programs, all of those have additional value add that can stack in a really attractive way. The challenge has been training the workforce, right? Establishing the key criteria for what that workforce looks like and is paid in labor, and then also getting the manufacturing facilities up and running so that we're actually making this equipment. All of that has been in the works, I'd say. And it's been since August of 22 was when the IRA was passed. So we're closing on, a year and a half, 18 months. And what's interesting is this rise of U.S. manufacturing. And so, I mean, the number, I think I just recently read that it had doubled the investment in U.S. manufacturing up to, $180 billion compared to previous years. A lot of that is going into EVs. You're seeing a huge investment in Michigan and then also in some other key red states, which is strategic, right? I mean, it's, you're seeing a policy that has a lot of political views on opposite sides that's top of these campaign trails to what this it was either instrumental to the Biden administration and proving what they accomplished or to what potentially, Trump has stated that he's going to repeal on the first day. But what's most important is this is a law, how a bill becomes a law. I watch this with my kids all the time. If you Google it, I mean, we watched it in elementary school, but it's important because the process for the balance of power in DC, while seems chaotic, is pretty extensive. So you can make amendments and changes that have to go through some pretty extensive legal requirements to repeal anything. And I compare that to, there were attempts to repeal Obamacare. But what's threaded into all of the tax credits, tax incentives, the technology, and then the complications, we've already left the station as far as investing in U.S. manufacturing in red states. And if you have procurement from the projects that are going to benefit from that equipment that are planned in the queue, that part of the market has already taken off, and those are real jobs. And it's interesting to look at this rise of manufacturing compared to the days of, assembly lines. Or I was recently so impressed with Form Energy's announcement for their, I think it's iron technology to store long-term storage. And they broke ground to build that facility in West Virginia at a former steel manufacturing plant that's right on the exact location we were building the weapons we needed in World War, in armory that we needed in World War II. So the history is deep. Wow. It's an incredible story. It's amazing to think that we could be making product and equipment again here in the U.S. And these are really cool facilities. So from, you know, AI to robots to it's just a next gen of the Industrial Revolution. And it's, you know, in locations that these communities need these jobs. And so that alone, if you stack the type of equipment, who's building it and where it's located, I put those three buckets, or those are your adders. Then as far as the tax credit and the quality, you know, the technology that qualifies, you mentioned geothermal, you know, the language around what type of technology qualifies. And then there's a change in 25 that's a technology neutral tax credit, where it is incentivizing more innovative solutions of bringing different technologies together, whether it be, you know, wind and solar, batteries and hydrogen. Geothermal is interesting and kind of seeing where that goes. And then there's still this area of where natural gas peaker facilities, if they have carbon capture, natural gas, does that qualify? It, you know, the language that was just ruled, they got kind of left behind in the last package, but that could be an interesting adder if an administration changes and lobbies for it. So there's certainly some opportunity to continue following and ensuring that, you know, you're navigating the most lucrative and valuable path forward with this climate bill. And it was written, you know, until 2032. So that's historic. We used to have annual extensions on tax credits every year, except in 2006, we had an 8-year extension. And so leading up to 2030, like, there's tremendous opportunity in the energy industry to take advantage of all of these policy implications.
Yeah, that there's a lot there. And it's exciting to hear about all of this investment and all of this growth. And really what I would say is the positive side, or the what seems like a very optimistic and exciting viewpoint. I'd like to hit a few concerns now as we talk about this. It seems like everything's a bright skies and roses, but I think we know that because we're coming into an election year and we can already hear the rhetoric about, seems like anything is a divisive issue. So as we think about these energy developers and these big, large projects, there will sometimes be some type of negative sentiment, whether it is the intermittency from wind and solar or the grid instability from too much of this intermittent power, and just in general conversations around NIMBY. Either losing your beautiful landscape views or talking about whatever else you want to say is a problem and why you don't want this renewable energy in your backyard. How do you see that conversation being addressed right now with in this energy landscape?
Well, I mean, I think so. Just going back to the roses and, you know, blue skies, and then an election year, like that is, they just don't mix, right? I mean, election years are chaotic as far as the information that is campaigned on from the presidential down to your local congressman. And so really fact checking and understanding what it is that they're stating that they are going to do, what can they do, and then how does that ultimately impact you, I think is really important as a, you know, constituent. But from a business landscape, these are not new concerns and new risk, right? This has been, you know, part of the discussion and points around renewables and the scale as far as concerns as to, you know, the impact on the grid or to the, you know, view from your backyard. And That's across the board, though. I mean, so permitting is a huge issue. It has been trying to make progress in that process has been at the height of the discussions here in DC. And in some ways, they've been favorable to FERC, kind of ruled at the end of last year, some favorable policies for regulatory processes for transmission lines. So you're seeing some, you know, tailwinds as far as what is going to keep this industry moving forward. But I mean, the NIMBY discussion is important. And I think that the value add and the benefit is not necessarily communicated as well. And it hasn't been, and maybe hasn't taken into account the direct impact on local communities, but you're seeing huge requirements, especially in the DOE grants and funding, as far as community engagement plans to help get buy-in early on into what the value is going to be. And then, you know, I think that there's just a lot of local communities that have felt that development has been so disruptive to, you know, their local communities and impacted by, you know, if you look on the Gulf Coast, historic and catastrophic storms. So there's so much that's going on at the community level that is critical to kind of pull in key stakeholders early in order to ensure that you're not going to hit those roadblocks, which, I mean, you're seeing across the board in a lot of different projects from, you know, up in the Midwest with carbon capture sequestration projects getting blocked down to the Gulf Coast with some local backlash. And so it's just a critical part of the, you know, keys to success. And I think your question was, you know, what is this overarching kind of impact as far as risk to, you know, this wave of potential funding to be deployed into these projects in the energy industry. I mean, I think it's too soon to tell the direct impact on cost, project cost, because the requirements as far as just even the amount of time and effort that's going into these stakeholder meetings, those are added cost into development, right? And added time as far as having to go through and get the different groups engaged. So on top of it's the labor requirements that are just, we pay better here when you have, you know, unionized labor. And these are supposed to incentivize longstanding jobs. So workforce training through local colleges. So there's a definitely investment in value add. We just don't know how that impacts the overall economics. And that kind of rolls up to the overall impact of how any of these, headwinds are going to impact, you know, this moving forward.
Yeah. Okay. And another discussion point, as we think of the U.S. manufacturing aspect, bringing into the IRA and this renewable energy push, there's two overarching ideas. One, having U.S. manufacturing and the growth of renewable energy obviously helps us decarbonize that manufacturing. There's still, to me, a challenge, though, that we have a lot of raw materials that are still coming from overseas. So we still have a international, globalized supply chain that is potentially adding risk or adding additional emissions and emissions that we don't really control. So I don't know if I've got a specific question here on that, but what, when people are thinking about that side of it in terms of reshoring their manufacturing or trying to invest in more environmentally friendly raw supplies and raw materials, what what are some of those ideas and guidance points that you think about, and what do you see right now from this larger scale supply chain?
Well, I mean, the geopolitical process behind commerce is extremely complex. And, you know, I don't claim to be an expert by any means in all of these different materials, minerals that go into creating, you know, the battery or EV and what we're making. You know, I do know that commerce has extensive work on this issue and navigating it. And to be fair, it's important to show how far we've come. I mean, you know, you can look at it two ways. It's a little disappointing to know that so many of these products were coming from not as great of environmental, you know, requirements abroad or labor, but you know, all of that is starting to become more transparent. I think it's a huge opportunity for the oil and gas industry to speak more proactively to their safety and environmental progress that they've made. And so I think you're going to start to see, you know, more of that speculation across the board with renewables. The SEC's climate disclosure requirements is going to also, I think, stimulate and put a lot of more interest on being more transparent regarding the products that you use to produce your widget. And that was just announced in the last 2 weeks. So, you know, whether, you know, we were just not as highly regulated or there wasn't as much as, you know, demand from kind of capital markets and investors into how business as usual was being conducted previously, it's changed. And so I think it's very important to not just make bold statements about what we don't have. It's, you know, there's a value add to our country of what we do have. And those relationships that are, you know, with geopolitical partners. And then I think, you know, stabilizing any of those relationships and agreements is important. The LNG export pause, I think, is extremely, you know, confusing to the global economy. I think it trickles upstream in ways that we have not realized yet. And then, you know, it creates a wave of uncertainty with, you know, our allies to, you know, the real progress that can be made and resources that are coming from the U.S. So, you know, I see both sides to that one specific issue and to what is the intent because of the process of going through DOE. But I also think that there's, you know, there's maybe a better way to communicate it, roll it out. It's certainly gotten legs of a very, very negative connotation and message at a time when, you know, our country is better than that. And it's just unfortunate with everything else that's going on to think we're going to cause that much chaos here.
Yeah, that's a really good point that there are those levels of now uncertainty coming from the resources that we commit to and say we'll provide, which does add a probably a viewpoint that most people don't always think about. So with all of the conflicts that are going on and the kind of political state of affairs and really talking about the fact that it's an election year, what with all of those and how those impact supply chains, shipping routes, global economy, is there anything in particular that you think is being particularly impactful or most impactful for U.S. manufacturing and specifically U.S. renewable energy growth?
I just think it's an incredibly exciting time. I mean, if you can, being in D.C., I've learned how to compartmentalize what is all over the news and what is being said and is focused on to there is, you know, these discussions at the boardroom level of all of these different energy technologies, where we are today and the opportunity of where we have to go is incredible to me. I mean, in 2003, when I started out, solar was extremely expensive and we had complete dependence on foreign oil, right? I mean, and that was, you know, peak oil was in sight, pre-shale revolution. So if you look at in 20 years where we've, where we, how far we've come to A, the just explosion of both of these technologies and what we have built in the US, and then where we can go from here, being open-minded and kind of thinking through how to navigate, is, you know, primarily where we really focus. Trying to understand the geopolitical dynamics between all of the products and critical pieces that go into the ultimate end, you know, of the project producing the in cash flowing, the EV driving, like, I mean, that is beyond complicated, technical in ways that we don't necessarily get into. But there's so much happening just in the US economy. It's incredible to be a part of it. I will say that, you know, I think all of the hype, now we're 4 years post pandemic, right? It's hard to think back that just this week was when everything started shutting down and the chaos, and looking to what's happened in just 4 years, you know, on a global level, you can see some parallels and trends that might reoccur as far as, you know, countries to work with and issues to work on and ways to navigate that hopefully is a more stable and less uncertain future our next 4 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting. So before we get into the final questions, just to end on a high note, what are we do see this growth. What are some of the things that we can be doing to continue and maybe increase that rate of renewable energy growth in this current market?
With renewables, you know, I think just energy education in general is kind of where I like to start. I think facts and reality of, you know, electrification has its own risk, and being kind of open-minded and understanding the value add that our historical fossil fuels have provided, I think is important. So, you know, we typically challenge both sides that, you know, there is a huge wave of demand for a decarbonized energy economy, and looking at what that really means and how to get there in an affordable, reliable way that ultimately does take local communities into account and the impact there, and create some good high paying jobs. Like that's good for everybody, right? So, yeah. I mean, I just would say to encourage, there's a value add to not just the renewables and a cleaner environmental impact, but also into the quality and how the projects are made, what they're made with, and who is building them. All of those come into play.
I like it. That is a good thing that everybody really should learn. And at least if they don't fully understand it, at least appreciate it. So with that, I want to transition into these final questions. These are the questions I ask all of my guests. That first question being, what is a favorite book of yours that you would recommend?
Oh, this is a good one. And I wasn't prepared for it, but there's this great book that I go back to all the time, but it's called Think Like a Warrior. And it's a sports book, but it's got just incredible kind of mental toughness and, you know, grit, references to, you know, how to continue to push yourself to be a better and more successful person. And so I read that with my kids all the time. It drives them crazy. I have everything highlighted in it. And then from a business perspective, I'm always reading energy books, historical energy books. I'm a complete geek about it. And, you know, no one ever would really, I think, guess that about me, but anything that comes to kind of the history of energy way back to the discovery of oil in the 1900s and ancestors. I mean, I geek out about all of it. So, you know, you can find me in either of those, the self-help books or in the energy books, and that's about it.
All right. Well, I will add Think Like a Warrior to the list. So now the next question.
I don't even know who wrote it, but I was just reading it again this morning. I needed some inspiration, you know, just on those tough days. I have three kids, and you know, some of the toughest hours are just getting them out the door.
I can understand that. So now the next question, how do we get to net zero and beyond?
Joe, that's complicated, because what is net zero? Right. And now we're going negative net zero, or is it 24/7 matching net zero, or is it carbon free energy? So all of the terms have changed so much. And, you know, I mean, it just from what is green, the Federal Trade Commission is definitely coming down on that. I think there has been a lot of greenwashing. How do we get there? What is included in the SEC's requirements as far as carbon accounting is important. The GHG protocol is leading this too. So the actual accounting to go into what is clean, green, carbon-free is the first step. And so outside of that, that's progress, because it's actually a real quantified measurement that we have never had before. And then where we go from there, once that is determined and standardized, I'll come back to your question of how we're going to get there, because I don't think we know what we're counting yet.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. And I think it's a point that people are highlighting more and more, especially right now, as there starts to be real, both incentives as well as
customer demand, right? I mean, you know, my kids are part of it. I mean, you know, I think if there was a sustainable shoe or a carbon-free net zero Nike that was marketed, and, you know, and that has an impact on this generation of, oh, well, that must be a better shoe. And so are you paying more for it? Is it worth a premium? Do we really know that that's a fact? It came here in an Amazon package, and I know that that's not carbon free, or is it? Where is it offset? You know? So, I mean, I think it's really important. I think it's a great opportunity if you're starting to look into how to get into this business, if you have an interest in numbers, to really, you know, sharpen your pencils and look at the accounting field, because the process that is going to be required, that is, if you are going to charge a premium for any additional added benefit to your widget, is going to be a long-standing job, because this isn't going away. Mm-hmm. And I think it's good. I mean, you know, smart water, I always joke about that. Like, does it make me smarter? Does it influence that I bought that water versus the other? I take no trade drops for any of the names I'm stating. I'm just saying on a daily basis, it makes you kind of more aware as to what's being marketed to you, and then how all of that flows down to ultimately, where's the real value at?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really interesting point that I have not thought about or really dug into yet. But we do often see or perceive a added value to these sustainable products, and we do pay a premium for those. But as we talk about carbon credits or carbon incentives or tax credits, these companies, if they are doing everything they can also get those tax credits. So now, and this is me just thinking out loud, putting this out there to the world, but they're getting tax credits as well as getting a premium for their product. And so,
this is right.
So they're getting a double win, which it's an interesting thought on how that works in the larger economy.
But this isn't new. I mean, and I think it's really important to break it down to, with the green electron in the early days, there was a value add to the electron that went to produce power, right? So you had a customer buying the power. You also had a value add to the tax credit on your spreadsheet. And then you also had a green value to your electron. And so all of those are bumps into what ultimately is a produced electron. And so when you start to think about, you know, it in pretty simple black and white terms, you know, this is, it's not new, but people are paying more attention to it and trying to say, you know, what is the value add of the green to this? Or can I charge a premium? Is there a demand for it? And fundamentally, I mean, I think it comes down to, if it says it was made in America, I ultimately probably trust it more just because it's a local product and I know I'm buying something from America, but am I willing to pay more for it? Can I afford to pay more for it? So I think the tax credits are incentivizing that to stimulate that part of the economy, because when everything is so cheap, maybe it's too cheap.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. So now you get to ask me a question.
Well, what is, Joe, your favorite Mexican food restaurant in Houston? I know mine.
Oh, favorite Mexican food restaurant in Houston.
Or in Texas.
Yeah.
You like Tex-Mex, don't you?
I do. So I am more of a like traditional street taco kind of guy.
Okay.
And so I live in Dallas, so make it down to Houston for work probably once a month.
Dallas more has great taco places though. They're just popping up everywhere.
Yeah, they are. And so the two that I really like, there's Fuel City Tacos, which is, it's a Fuel City gas station. I think there's a few of them, but they've got like a taco, taqueria in their inside. And they've got just great tacos, cash only. And they're like $1, $1.50 each, but you have to buy like five to get full.
Sure.
So it's traditional.
That's still really cheap.
Yeah. There's another one called El Atron. And I don't actually know what that means, but they have really good street tacos. And that's another one that is, those are the two that I like to frequent in Dallas. I think when I'm in Houston, typically we end up at, I forget the name, but it's something.
There's El Tiempo is one of my favorites.
Yep.
I think that's we lived in Houston. So I've been in DC for 20 years, but we moved to Houston for two. I had two of my babies in the Houston area. So we frequented, you know, Mexican food restaurants. It's for me, it's the ambiance, because you can have crying babies, children running around, the chaos, and still drink your margarita and eat your chips and, you know, also feel like a normal human being. Any other restaurant, like, not going to take my kids to. Luckily, they're older now and we can do the street tacos, but it may have just been the chaos that I really enjoyed while we were in Houston when they were young. And then Chewy's is another one that maybe you're thinking of. I'm trying to think about, I've been to them all and they come and we don't have good Tex-Mex in DC. And there's one place called Cactus that's over by the National Cathedral. And there's a couple of others, but I always make it a point to actually come back to Texas. And I built a business to come back to Texas to get some good Tex-Mex. So I'm glad I have some more tips.
Yes, Tex-Mex can do wonderful things.
As long as it's powered by clean energy.
Yes, absolutely.
At a fuel station. Yep. They must have, do they have EV chargers at the fuel station? You have to look the next time.
I honestly haven't looked too closely.
You don't get gas there and you don't drive an EV. I don't either.
No.
My kids keep asking me why I don't. And I said, because, I mean, we have one vehicle and it's got to be reliable. And I'm not saying that EVs aren't reliable, but I'm just terrified about like losing power. So I have a huge SUV that, you know, probably doesn't make the, my friendly environmentalist, friends happy, but you know, I balance it out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about balance.
Well, I know. Well, thank you, Joe. This was fun. Yeah, it's great to talk to you.
Yeah. Thank you for joining me on the show. Before we sign off, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Oh, no. This has been great. I hope to come back and we can talk about if we've made any progress on all the things we covered.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely have you back on the show.
Great. And I'll just say, anybody who, you know, wants to learn more about our firm, you can look me up on LinkedIn. That's always the easiest way, but it's Novus Energy Advisors, N-O-V-U-S, energyadvisors.com is our website. And we're a small firm. I've got an awesome business partner. So we're pretty fun to work with on tackling big issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll definitely have a link in the show notes for everybody to Emily's LinkedIn and to Novus Energy Partners. So, Emily, thank you again. And thank you, everyone, for joining us on this episode of the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, share it with a friend and leave a review telling me what you're enjoying most or what you'd like to hear more of. If you want more news and energy-related stories, we have all sorts of energy-related podcasts on OGGN. You can find them by connecting with us on LinkedIn or visiting the website. Finally, if you have any questions, comments, corrections, or have a story that you would like to share, send me an email. That email is joe.battier@oggn.com. And if you don't use email, find me on LinkedIn. Until next time, remember to keep it low carbon and high energy.
Join us again next week for another low carbon, high energy story on the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast, a production of the Oil and Gas Global Network. Learn more at oggn.com.